Hi, this is Paul. This is going to be kind of a hodgepodge of things I ran across this morning and things that have my attention. There's the Jordan Peterson document of the ARC, the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship, and the video that he put out to introduce that, and the Peugeot Hurwitz video, and a few other things, but I want to start with Brett Anderson's little quote that he put out on Twitter. I don't know where it's from, so if you know where it's from, just drop it in the comment section. There is a human being who has turned out badly, who does not have enough spirit to enjoy it, but just enough education to realize this. Just does not have enough spirit to enjoy it. Enjoy what? Enjoy his spirit that he's been given. Does not have enough spirit to enjoy it. But just enough education to realize this. He is bored, disgusted, and despises himself. Having inherited some money, he is deprived even of the last comfort, the blessings of work, self-forgetfulness in daily labor. Such a person who is fundamentally ashamed of his existence eventually ends up in a state of habitual revenge, will to revenge. What do you suppose he finds necessary? Absolutely necessary to give himself, in his own eyes, the appearance of superiority over more spiritual people. Now we're going to have to deal with that word spiritual. So the quest for a spiritual home is the theme of the conference coming up in May. The links are below if you want to sign up for it in Chino, California. And so much of what we wrestle with is, what is this word spiritual? How do we use it? What do we mean by it? People use it all over the place, and if you press them on it, they seem to have very little understanding of exactly what they're trying to say, even though it seems they're quite earnest in saying that it's of ultimate value. What do you suppose he finds necessary, absolutely necessary, to give himself in his own eyes the appearance of superiority over more spiritual people and to attain the pleasure of an unaccomplished revenge, at least in his own imagination? Always morality. You can bet on that. Always big moral words. Always the rub-a-dub of justice, wisdom, holiness, and virtue. Love to know what that quote is from. I might be embarrassed by whoever he says it from, but it's an amazing quote. And obviously, the quote could mean a lot of different things if embedded in other places. So much of what we wrestle with is, in fact, what the book of Ecclesiastes in the NIV translation says: he has placed eternity in our hearts. Of course, Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground figures here that we imagine that once we could make our biological skin-wrapped entities sufficient with food, sufficient with security, then we, like this giant gator that I once saw in a Florida gator park, would simply be happy lounging in a pool of warm water. I asked the guy who was working at the gator, seeing this enormous alligator sitting in this pool, does he get bored? Nah, he'd just throw chicken at him. And there he lives his life in the pool. And we are haunted with things. And part of the tell that we are haunted is our continual need for distraction and amusement. Unlike the gator that sits in that pool, I believe his name was Goliath. Unlike the gator that sits in that pool, we must have our Netflix, or our dramas, or our podcasts, or whatever. This C.S. Lewis quote from The Problem of Pain, you'll hear me repeat regularly. The Christian doctrine of suffering explains, I believe, a very curious fact about the world we live in. The settled happiness and security, which we all desire, God withholds from us by the very nature of the world, but joy, pleasure, and merriment. And this lovely little quote, is deprived even of the last comfort, the blessings of work, self-forgetfulness in daily labor. Joy, pleasure, merriment, he has scattered broadcast. We are never safe, but we have plenty of fun and some ecstasy. It is not hard to see why. The security we crave would teach us to rest our hearts in this world and oppose an obstacle to our return to God. And so when I think about the quest for a spiritual life, we have to wrestle with this two worlds mythology and the quest for a spiritual home. I'm going to have to make sure I don't continue to misquote this. The quest for a spiritual home, because the first question you have to ask is, where is this home and what do we mean by home? I think John Vervaeke is right in his meaning crisis when he talks about domicide. But humanity has long had a condition of domicide. And in many ways in the Bible, this is set in motion, right with the story of the garden first, and then Cain is cast out from the presence of the Lord next, and Cain is also the first city builder, and of course Noah is in an ark looking for home. Babel is an attempt to build a home in such a way and as to secure for itself a home. And of course, Abram is commanded to leave his home and go to a place that will be a new home, and that journey continues. We are never safe, but we have plenty of fun and some ecstasy. It's not hard to see why the security we crave would teach us to rest our hearts in this world and oppose an obstacle to our return to God. In that sense, for Lewis, God is our home. A few moments of happy love, a landscape, a symphony, a merry meeting with our friends, a bath, or a football match have no such tendency. These things can put us in a little mini or a larger flow state where we are so, in a sense, a flow state perhaps gives us a virtual home where we are at, but that, you know, Vervaeke talks about flow states as you know, sort of an insight cascade. We are taken out of ourselves in those moments, but we almost can't live there. When I think about, I talked about this a little bit in my Sunday school class, when I think about what people imagine our ultimate existence would be, it seems to be a flow state that is increasingly meaningful and pleasurable, but one that does not exhaust us. Because obviously flow states are sort of heightened levels of attention and they exhaust us. Our Father refreshes us on the journey with some pleasant inns, but not to encourage us to mistake them for home. Now, this conversation with Jonathan Peugeot and Greg Hurwitz, I enjoyed immensely. And as almost always the case with conversations like this, Hurwitz has dropped some little teasers about his background. And if he's done a biography video on YouTube, somebody drop it in the comment section. I haven't noticed it, or maybe I don't often pursue some of these guys to sort of do my thing with them. But I'd love to do it with Hurwitz and listen to his story. And because he went to Catholic school, that came out in the biblical series, or in the Exodus seminar, but you don't get the sense that he finds his home in church. Jonathan Peugeot, who often tells people to go to church, picks up and explains what he means by going to church. And in a sense, what he almost says is, let's let Jonathan say it.
Yeah, and I think that that...
Well, I better have my sound settings set for that properly. Here we go. This should work.
That's why, in some ways, when I tell people, there's a catchphrase I say, people, I say, go to church. And what I mean by that is, in some ways, it's you have to engage in the human relationships around you. That's like the best way to go about that. You know, you have...
That's very interesting. For a generation, at least, the big conservative battle, at least on an evangelical front, has been, well, just look at James Dobson, what he named his organization and his radio program. Focus on the family. Now, there's been some pushback on that has been not simply that the nuclear family is sufficient or insufficient, but that the nuclear family is really only one particular aspect of family. There's the extended family, there's the kin group, et cetera, et cetera. But it's amazing that Jonathan sort of defines his go to church in that way. Let's let him talk a little more.
You have relationship, you have a family, you have some kind of community around you. And so that's the best place to go, because...
And I think in that way, he sort of says, okay, in some way, because of the pervasive mobility that has been happening, your church has to sort of be your family. And, you know, the little churches that I've been a part of, that's very much been the case.
In some ways, that's the place that will have this procedural aspect to it that will ground the other stuff. You know, it's like if you have to, you know, to help your kids with their homework, or you have to do this kind of really grounded stuff that has nothing, that's very little to do with the ideology. You get engaged in other people's lives, then it binds you in a different way, right? It binds you in a way.
You can't outsource that. You know, it's like one of the things I say sometimes is that luxury will be the death of us.
Mm.
Right. It's like you could hire someone to go teach your kids, coach your kids' soccer games. Right. You could have someone else do that. Like, we could always be way too busy with our own lives than to do the stuff that's the real bonding. And then it's not even just that you're coaching your kid at soccer. It's that you're driving them. Right. And then you have that car time that you're not looking at each other. So there's more information, and you're driving them and their teammates. And when they're in the back, they're talking differently, and you get a different, you know, view of that. And then there's kind of discipline, and there's different rules that you engage with on the field. And then there's different celebrations through, like, there's so much stuff to it versus being like, well, I'm busy, someone else can do that.
Mm.
You lose all of that texture.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's tempting. I mean, I imagine for you, for me, for sure, because there's so much pulling, like, it's so much pulling. There's so much to do. Like, you could just, there's so many opportunities. And it's like,
yeah,
you gotta be careful.
Family, don't bother me. I'm carving Jesus. Leave me alone.
But, you know, growing up, my father's ministry, you know, one of the regrets that my father had was some of the choices that he made. And I probably share some of that too. Maybe not to the degree that my father did, but, you know, don't bother me. I'm saving Patterson. But the focus here is, again, on sort of this nuclear family. There's perhaps something of a background of romanticism in this. Earlier in the video, Jonathan was talking about the family meal as good section on attention there. The family meal is sort of this place, this ritual, spiritual place where you learn to have a conversation, where you learn to, you know, measure your appetites because you're sharing your food, where you do all of these things. But of course, this is all set in really a post-industrialization context. Now, so what? That's the context we are. There's no other context we need to do this. And it's in some ways the height of modernity to try to sort of elevate ourselves with a monarchical vision to look for something that isn't merely modernity or post-industrialization or all of these things. Yet when I go back to Lewis's quote, so much of the anxiety going on right now is the sense that, especially in places like Canada and the United States, and to a degree in Western Europe too, of course, after the Second World War, we achieved a degree of prosperity and comfort and security that we are anxious about. And one of the funny things about prosperity and security is that when you don't have them, you sort of have the meaningful pursuit of them, which, especially in Jordan Peterson's schema, is almost divinity. And then when you do secure them, you have the anxiety around losing them that sort of propels you into what? And that's kind of where this vision, the Alliance of Responsible Citizenship, ARC, and of course he makes no apologies for the relationship with the Genesis ARC. And there's a sense in which this for Jordan is an attempt to build an ARC of sorts. The Alliance of Responsible Citizenship, right there, in a monarchy, you are subjects. In a democracy, you are citizens. If you live in a democracy, you live in a Protestant world. You might be a Roman Catholic in that Protestant world. You might be an Orthodox person in that Protestant world. But you live in that Protestant world. And even if you say, oh, I live in my religious monarchy beneath the democracy of the liberal West, well, then either you are looking for a king to rule over you that is higher than the president or the Congress or all of that, or you basically live within the covenant of religious rights and freedoms where your community has its liberty to have its own monarchy. Now, Thursday, I'm going to be having a conversation with Cale Zeldin about Jordan on Twitter and his spat with the Pope. But there's a lot going on with this. Jordan, of course, 17 hours ago tweeted, Catholic is something that you are, not something you believe. Orthodoxy too. Protestantism? A harder question. Well, I thought the harder question is to the degree that you can be Orthodox or Roman Catholic without being deeply impacted by the Protestant spirit after the Enlightenment. And if you live in the West, there's almost no going about it. Cale Zeldin tweeted this morning, people really don't like Jordan Peterson. This is true, which makes it all the more interesting, which makes him all the more interesting. Other people certainly like him, of course. But why? And that's fascinated me watching this happen. And I think Cale gets at a bunch of these things here. Or I see a ton of people angry yet dismissive of his massive following and reach. Donald Trump was a joke until he was a serious candidate for president, until he was president, until he's a threat to once again become president with his angry, bitter self. And then where on earth would that lead? I have no idea. Bad tweets notwithstanding, ha. I wonder why so many feel compelled to explain to their audience why he's such a hack or a loon or dangerous.
Laura Back.
Nate had a nice video on Grail Country 5 months ago. I don't know how Nate feels about this. Maybe he'll jump Thursday on our live stream. But he had a nice video, nice conversation with Laura, who's very much been in the corner, part of the Chicago group. And she and I have had some really interesting conversations on, she's Catholic, and on Catholic communities, on the Benedict option, on how this goes. And they had a really interesting conversation about Jordan.
Again with me today. We're going to have another conversation on Jordan Peterson. The last time we talked about Jordan Peterson, we focused a lot on her experience of encountering Jordan Peterson in the early days of the first Jordan Peterson wave. And we really focused a lot on how Jordan Peterson was being very helpful to people on an individual level, and in a very real way, was kind of helping to lift people out of, you know, hells of their own personal creation.
Yeah, that's a good summary.
And which is why I gave the provocative title that Jordan Peterson was harrowing hell to that video. So that's what I was talking about. And that, I think that's pretty indisputably the case. Unless you just want to totally ignore the testimony of the, like, hundreds of thousands of people who would tell you that was the case, which I don't think makes any sense, because that's just anti-relational and nonsensical. And not everything has to be to the level of a scientific study to be admitted into evidence. And the personal experience and testimony of people matters. So anyway, we wanted to, now we did get some negative feedback from someone who we think was a good faith actor.
From a friend of mine.
Yeah, a friend of Laura's. And he chose to delete the comment. I would never have asked him to delete the comment. I thought it was completely unbound. Some of the criticisms of Peterson that he was making are criticisms that I've made myself many times in the past. And so what generally the concern that he expressed was that what Jordan Peterson is pushing people toward is not a Christianity in any deep sense, but a kind of a surface level cultural Christianity combined with a political conservatism that just gives to, you know, a kind of comfortable acceptance of a status quo in our culture that a lot of people would find problematic.
I think Nate put that really well, as he's quoting the other critic.
I'll just summarize it that way.
Yeah, I think that's what he was saying. And on that note, well, you know, I might actually swing around because my lighting is so weird here. Is this any better?
Ah, if we get a little bit more light coming from the window there, that's a little better.
Yeah, it might be better.
It's okay. Anyway, you're in shadow. It's fine.
Yeah. So, so on that note, I would say that one of the things that was kind of magical about him in those early days was that he wasn't telling people to do anything really specific. And he wasn't funneling them into some kind of single pre-existing movement or institution, right? It was never like, hey, if you like what I'm saying, go join my paramilitary group or something, right?
I think some people actually think that's what he's doing, though.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think my friend would think that, but but some people do, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
is this little corner a paramilitary group? We need uniforms.
So what he had was that kind of magic or charism, if you want to say it that way, that really, really good preachers have. And I think one of the reasons people got so excited about him was that there are a lot of people who have never heard a good sermon before, you know, a sermon that really makes you want to be a better person. And you walk out of church standing up a little straighter and thinking, yeah, I'm going to do the right thing, you know? And I hadn't heard that in a while because I hadn't been engaged with church life because I had decided, like, it probably was all not worth what I had thought it was worth, you know. So anyway, but I was going to say, in terms of what he's encouraging people to do, or like what he moves people into, right? Does he move people into bourgeois, comfortable Christianity? I don't think I would put it that way, because when people hear him, they decide to do all kinds of different things. And that's that's kind of what's interesting about him, where that's
you also that's have a hard time, if that's the case, you have a hard time explaining the deep bond and connection with Jonathan Pageau.
Yeah.
Because that is definitely because Pageau often becomes the gateway, like a lot of the people who moved to Christianity from Jordan Peterson, a lot of them ended up leaning Orthodox, and I think that's probably because of the Pageau influence there.
I don't think that
the kinds of things that Pageau talks about could be just remotely described as that at all.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Did you see his talk from the Thunder Bay conference?
I had started it. I think I've seen about 15 minutes of it, but I really like the topic and the approach. Yeah, I'm going to watch the whole thing eventually.
Yeah, he really, like, if you really want to know, like, if you want to just see, like, a really good high-level summary of what Pageau is all about, like, that's, mm-hmm. he gets, like, that's him, I think, articulating the Christian Neoplatonic worldview in a very simple, easy-to-understand way that, that apparently only scientists with PhDs have a hard time following.
Yes, yeah. And so try and land the plane that I just got off the ground a minute ago. The point is that when people heard Jordan Peterson in those kind of magical early times, they tended to make all kinds of different resolutions about what they needed to do, because something about the way he spoke to them was very effective, but also very generalizable, or very it was affecting them at a deep level, so that so many people would hear him and they'd be like, oh, now I know what I have to do. But it was always something different, because it was always mm-hmm. something that pertained to their own life, right? Mm-hmm. They'd hear him and they'd say, oh, I have to be nicer to my mom. Or they'd hear him and they'd say, oh, I know what I need to do at work. I need to go in there and, like, act with integrity and work really hard and meet all my deadlines and not manipulate the other people at my workplace, you know. People would make all kinds of different resolutions about how they could live a better life, all just based on, you know, maybe one thing that he said. so that was that's the gift that he has, I think, is that he doesn't funnel people into any one specific thing. He just inspires them to do better. At his best, that's what he's doing.
Right. Yeah, that is what he's at his best, what he's doing. And I think, like, what causes the reaction that your friend had is, like, some of his political forays. Definitely, like, the Twitter behavior but here's the thing, though. Yes, he had the really awful Twitter behavior, but then he also was the kind of person who would have a friend who was critical of his Twitter behavior on along with Jonathan Pageau to mediate, to talk about that Twitter behavior and acknowledge where he might have gone wrong.
Yeah, and that reminds me of something that I wanted to talk about here, which is, have you ever said, when somebody asks you about a public figure, I don't agree with everything he says, but I like such and such about him? Have you ever said that?
Yeah.
Lots of times. Yeah, I have too. You know, but I got to thinking about, like, why do we even say that? Because, Nate, have you ever known anyone in your entire life that you agreed with every single thing they ever said?
No.
So why would you ever need to preface your assessment of somebody with, I don't agree with everything he says, but...
Right, yeah, I know. We do it all the time, though.
Yeah, we do it all the time.
Yeah.
And this is the case with Peterson. Like, I could say that about him. I could preface all my assessments of him with, I don't agree with everything he says, because I don't agree with everything he says. But that can't be a benchmark for how you evaluate people. Oh, I agree with everything he says.
Right.
You know, this person and I... on a Venn diagram are just a single
circle. Wouldn't be different. You would actually not be different. You would actually not be different persons if that were the case, right?
Right. The implication there is I only really approve of people who are actually me, you know?
Right. Exactly. Yes. Yes. That's right. There's definitely an absolute egocentricity in doing it. And the fact that we say that is kind of evidence of our default egocentric orientation, because, like, why is that even part of the calculus?
Right. So I actually made a resolution to just stop saying that about anyone ever.
That's a really good resolution. I should stop saying that too. Yeah. I think I will say this, though, in defense of by saying that, usually I usually say it to soften a critique that I feel that I need to make, and to, like, acknowledge that I still see the fundamental value of the person as a person.
Although softening a critique sounds more to me like you should be saying, I agree with some of the things.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, that's true.
It's more like softening admiration when you say I don't agree with.
Yeah, others. I guess. Yeah.
Distance. But it's a desire to protect yourself, right?
Yeah.
Because if
I don't want to be so closely identified with this person that everything that's negative, exactly. I think is the cultural game we play where if you're associated with a person, you are guilty of whatever crimes that person is guilty of. Is that driving us to talk like that more?
I think so.
I think it is.
Yeah.
So, and this is a very real thing. I'm going to give a real world example
of
this coming into play. And it's going to cause me to make a critique of someone who I have deep admiration for and whose thought has been profoundly beneficial to me and who I deeply admire. And that's David Bentley Hart.
And you can go and watch the rest of the video if you want to watch Nate's critique of David Bentley Hart. It's an excellent conversation. Well, not in any way surprised it was an excellent conversation, given that it's between Laura and Nate Heil, both of whom are just top-shelf conversation partners. So back to Kale's tweets. The he's just discourse is telling, but I believe his critics are mostly reacting to a Potemkin version of him. If you spend any time at all listening, watching, reading, you might find him strangely compelling. You might also begin to ask yourself why. Why is he compelling? Michael Martin, the sociologist, Catholic academics in particular, have turned this phenomena into a pathology. Kale, they are worse than the mainstream media guys who just call him an alt-right monster. So, I thought, you know, Nate first and then Kale really said something good. Now, of course, if he has a section in his video called The Good News, I'm simply going to have to listen to it. Jordan, as somebody else pointed out on Twitter, Jordan has been taking any and everyone on, in a sense. Oh, let's see, where am I at here? A couple interesting things rose in the thread. Where is it? Among his events is I hear that Jordan said Peterson eats with sinners. Joseph Sciambra, who's a very interesting person, he dares to criticize the Catholic Church, then combined with the power of deep church and the deep state came after him. Giordano Bruno, New Jersey, says people don't like him, but his podcast is consistently in the top 75 podcasts across all genres. And I think that's partly Kale's point of why people don't like him. And so now with this ARC. Now, if you look at who the organizing committee, organizing spelled in the British sort of way, many of these people, I don't know who they are. Some of them have been on his channels. Bjorn Lomberg, we know, is someone that he thinks a lot of. But it's quite a group. Dan Crenshaw has been on his channel. James Orr, of course, was part of the Exodus Seminar. Jonathan Peugeot. Poor Jonathan. John Anderson, of course. Jordan's had quite a few conversations with John Anderson. John Anderson's podcast has grown quite a bit. John Anderson, former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia. And then there's Jordan. Louise Perry, I was kind of surprised to see her on the page. Michael Johnson, who was on the channel, I didn't listen to that conversation, I usually skip. And Mike Lee, another politician, I usually skip the politicians and their conversation. Niall Ferguson, Stephen Blackwood, of course, he's president of Ralston College, and Jordan's worked quite a bit with him, another member of the Exodus Seminar. So this group of people with this, and yeah, I think, as I said earlier, in a sense, you have this question of, okay, to save the world, well, what are we saving it from? A big piece of Jordan's mission is to at least not lose what we've gained and not lose the potential that we've started. And obviously his concern is that we will take step backs in terms of poverty. I think, you know, I had never brought a lot of ideas to me that I had never thought of, one of which has been with respect to energy policy, that obviously higher energy prices impact the poor disproportionately than they impact the middle class and the wealthy. And I saw this in the Dominican Republic, where gasoline and diesel were subsidized, as was propane, by the government. This isn't terribly unusual in the developing world, because those governments know that their people are very dependent on gasoline, diesel, and propane. They subsidized propane basically because they wanted to stop deforestation in the Dominican Republic. They've been far more successful of that than they have been in Haiti. They subsidized gasoline. And a big part of what the pressures they were getting, and I'm not going to get into the pros and cons of this stuff because I don't really know anything about it, but there's a lot of pressure on these countries to stop subsidizing these things. Because in many cases, many of these governments, like the Dominican Republic, they had to buy their petroleum and propane in dollars, and so they were always struggling for dollars. And so when gas prices would go up, the subsidy obviously would go up, and it would hurt the country's ability to continue to do that. Now, the government also understood that in many ways, if gasoline prices go up and propane prices go up and diesel prices go up, suddenly the very poor people are going to be hurt quite a bit indeed. So a lot of what Jordan's been trying to do is not lose the gains that have been made, and he's sort of standing against others who are, you know, climate, people who believe that basically climate change is going to take us out in the near term. That's where Bjorn Lundberg comes in, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to get into that aspect of it, but that's in many ways the background for this arc he is looking to build.
And this is the statement of vision and invitation. It starts with, I'll tell you the structure of the proclamation or the vision statement, first of all. So when I wrote my book, Maps of Meaning, I analyzed the structure of redemptive stories. And your life is a redemptive story if you're fortunate, because you have a lot of trouble in your life, and yet you plow through and take care of that trouble, and that's a story of redemption. And the typical redemption...
And even just framing it that way, your life is a story of overcoming obstacles and fulfilling expectations, let's say, and achieving a better space, a productive space for more.
I'm looking at this recent, let's say, domination of a certain kind of storytelling.
And this, of course, is my conversation. I've played it a number of times with Dr. Jim about Westerns. And I do want to get more into Westerns. I've got a podcast from The Plow about Jesus and John Wayne that was really good.
And I'm seeing that something in the tradition that I am very familiar with is missing. It's not really there. And now I'm going to try to describe that thing that I think is missing. I played in my mind a couple of ways of trying to introduce this, and I think perhaps the simplest way is the Western. I studied Westerns for a while, about 10 or 15 years ago, and High Noon is kind of a classically structured Western. It's a 50s Western by a guy named Howard Hawks, and it's a very simple story. There's a sheriff. He is getting married to the pure girl from the East who arrives in town. She's a school teacher. He's going to get married to her, and he's going to give up his sheriff job because he's cleaned up the town and everything's hunky-dory, and he's going to ride off into the sunset with his new bride. And right at the beginning of the movie, The guy he put in jail 7 or 8 years ago or so has been unjustly let out of jail and is coming to town. He's going to recreate the bad world that he, that the sheriff had cleaned up. And in the midst of it, he's going to kill the sheriff. This, his goal is revenge against the sheriff. And the story plays out, you know, in somewhat complicated ways that aren't important to the point I'm trying to make. But of course, the wedding is off. He's now the sheriff again, and no one wants to help him. But the story builds to the point where there's the showdown. Of course, it's at high noon. And there's complications between him and the woman as, along the way. But in the end, right near the end of the movie, you know, mano a mano in the street, sheriff kills the villain and rides up the school teacher, his bride. He throws down the sheriff's star and they ride out of town. And that's the end of the movie. Now,
part of what's interesting is that the podcast I was listening to had mentioned that Western and noted, I think quite rightly, in contrast with some of the other Westerns that I've been watching and the Westerns that I'm thinking about, it's a rather pessimistic view of the people in the town, because they, of course, will not back him. And he throws down the star and he's disgusted by them and he walks off. In a lot of ways, this Jordan Peterson move is very Western-like, in that he's this man from northern Alberta wearing a rather Western-tailored. I mean, talk about the college professor from the East, the herringbone tweed with sort of the Western lapels. That's kind of who he is here. And that's very much sort of the mission that he's on. And so maps of meaning, narrative, the hero story with a generative future.
Mission story is something like, there's a stable state, a stable city, a stable family, a stable plan. And then that's disrupted by some cataclysmic event, the arrival of the barbarians, the entry of an interloper into a marriage, for example, some fracture occurs. There is a descent into an intermediary period of chaos.
Now this is a deeply Christian, this is the U-shaped story, okay? If Jess is here to talk about that, just from this little corner, this is a U-shaped story, because you have a stable order, you have the loss of that stable order, and you have the resumption, reclamation, redemption of that stable order.
And then there's the reestablishment of order that's of a higher order as a consequence. So you sort of go through life like this, and hopefully, you know, order, chaos, order, chaos, order, chaos, and hopefully, as you do that, the order gets deeper and more profound, and you get to be better at mediating between order and chaos. And this is an order chaos story, and it opens up with a description of the current state of order. And we called that the good news. So I'm going to read this, as I said, and comment on it. Life has improved dramatically over the past few centuries for almost everyone, everywhere, at an ever-accelerating rate. Far more people are thriving on our planet than we could have imagined even mere decades ago. We live longer, are increasingly and globally literate, educated and connected, and enjoy unparalleled access to fresh water, food, energy, and resources. Now that's quite the miracle, because back in the 1960s, when we started to become aware of our increasing industrial power and ability to operate at a planetary level, let's say, we started to get worried about such things as weather. Well, we were going to overpopulate the planet, and we were going to run out of food, and we were going to pollute everything into devastation, and the, you know, the whole civilizational endeavor was going to collapse into a degenerate chaos. And there was plenty of doomsaying at that time. Plenty of people, Paul Ehrlich, for example, at Stanford, who wrote The Population Bomb, and the Club of Rome, who were the original apocalyptic doomsayers on the environmentalist front, claiming that by the year 2000, there'd be mass starvation, we'd be running out of basic commodities, and that life was going to get a hell of a lot worse quickly. And so we better put the brakes to the population growth and deindustrialize rapidly, or look the hell out. And, you know, None of that turned out to be true. And the people who put that vision forward might say, well, you know, it's all a matter of time frame. Eventually, it's going to come true. And it's like, well, if your prediction is eventually I'm right, that's not a very good prediction, is it? You have to specify a time frame. And Ehrlich, by the way, Paul Ehrlich did specify a time frame in a very famous bet he had with Julian Simon, the economist. And Ehrlich lost famously. And what's happened actually is that we have way more people now than we thought we would in the year 2000. We have way more people now than people in 1965 thought would be on the planet in the year 2000, when all the starvation was supposed to hit. And by and large, people are way better off than they've ever been in the history of mankind. About 7 out of 8 billion people now have a reasonable standard of living. It's not luxurious, say, by North American standards, but they have enough to eat. They have a certain degree of security, and their children have a certain amount of opportunity. And they're still...
Go back to C.S. Lewis's Measure, okay? But of course, all of us, just look at the lives of the wealthiest, supposedly most secure people, the richest of the rich in North America. They still die of cancer. They still suffer from divorce, which, as Peter Kreef says, is worse than death. They still live in an insecure world, and they still work out their anxieties, whether that be of one political persuasion or another, on the media, trying to motivate the masses, trying to conjure up a massive spiritual body to move in order to achieve whatever thing they're trying to do. And of course, I think a huge part of the dislike for Jordan Peterson is the terror that he is summoning a body, a spiritual body, who will play a part in how the country goes. And of course, if this is part of the big hatred and for Donald Trump, you know, the Donald Trump's greatest sin is that he won in many respects. And again, I'm no anybody who knows my politics, not a fan of Donald Trump personally, but there it is.
Hundreds of millions of people who have trouble, but especially over the last 20 years, maybe since the Berlin Wall fell and the communists quit wrecking everything they got their hands on, we've moved away from absolute poverty at a pretty decent rate. So, and there's other good news as well. We exist in comparative peace. Violence of every form, from murder to insurrection, is increasingly rare and universally condemned, and fewer people than ever before confront the ravages of war. So we become less violent and more peaceful at every level of social organization. To note that all this is a miracle is still to understate the enormity of the accomplishment. And so, you know, we can take stock now in 2023 and think, well, we've got a fair number of problems and we're certainly not perfect, but things are a lot better than they might have been. And there is a lot of good news on the local, national, and international front. And so many problems, of course, remain. Hundreds of millions still labor under conditions of extreme privation. They're absolutely poor. We still organize ourselves less effectively than we might if we were truly wise. And we are still determining how to maintain our economic security and prosperity in an efficient, cost-effective, and nature-conserving manner. All right, so you don't have to be a Pollyanna to take optimistic stock of the current situation. You can note that 95% of the world was living in conditions of absolute privation by the UN definition of poverty in 1860, including in the West, and most people simply aren't burdened by that kind of inadequate provision in the modern world. And so that's a pretty good deal. Now, is it sustainable? Well,
sustainability. That back to Lewis's quote, because, well, all of those 8 billion people are going to die one way or another, at one point or another, and, you know, the quest for a spiritual home. Can this world provide such a home? We can talk about that as as this theme continues to roll in my mind, and I'm hoping to make a bunch of videos. In April, we'll have a conversation with myself, Jonathan Peugeot, John Vervaeke, John Van Donk, and Catherine in anticipation of the conference. And
that's not a good question. The better question is, under what conditions is it optimally sustainable or expanding? That's a better question. Questions are important. So you can say, perhaps, you can argue, the foundations are secure and good. We've learned how to act and to conduct ourselves both individually and socially so that true human flourishing is possible on a scale heretofore undreamed of and practically impossible. We put in place systems of governance that are, by historical standards, quite effective. There's been a sequence of absolute technological miracles that have enabled us to feed ourselves. We've been able to provide people with access to inexpensive energy, and energy is work, and work is the amelioration of absolute privation, and so that's all pretty damn good. So that's the upside, the realistic, non-naive upside. The challenge, so we might think that's the impending crisis. Despite all this good news, this undeniable progress, a shadow has emerged. An adversarial challenge to this state and process of expanding abundance.
Ah, if we're talking Western, someone, the bad guy, has emerged.
An emergent crisis of meaning and purpose. God is dead, or so the story goes, and the future is uncertain. 5 centuries of ascendant reductionist.
You could hear some of, now, Fukuyama. Forget who recently did a thing on Fukuyama, basically. Was it Brett Anderson? I don't remember. Yeah, Fukuyama wasn't read quite right, but so often the misreadings of someone can become sort of the mimetic gateway or even just the public perception of what they mean. And well, the end is history. We have now learned how to manage the economy. We now have energy. We have technology. We have, and if this just keeps going, the achievements that we have realized in the last century, have to pay in mind, we did have a couple of world wars in there, and the entire chapter of communism, then not to mention what on earth is going on in China and where that's going to go. But, you know, here in the West, we know how to organize a good life and to deliver it at scale in ways that were unimaginative for human beings before now.
Just enlightenment. God is dead, or so the story goes, and the future is uncertain. 5 centuries of ascendant reductionist enlightenment rationality have revealed that this starkly objective world lacks all intrinsic meaning. A century and a half or more of corrosive cultural criticism has undermined our understanding of and faith in the traditions necessary to unite and guide us.
So there's a double edge there. On one hand, the meaning crisis is very much present, and Dostoevsky's challenge in Tales of the Underground still stands. And beyond that, can this be maintained?
Well, we underwent the scientific revolution, started 500 years ago, say, and it concentrated on delineation of the nature of the objective world. We found out that the heavens were other than what we had presupposed, and that the God we had imagined inhabiting those heavens did not appear in the starkly empty and barren, immense, vast landscape of the cosmos. And we believe that if you were sensible and abandoned your superstitions, that you'd see the world as the cold, dead, mechanistic, inert object of process that it most truly is.
Now, of course, he's spitting out the voice. He is voicing modernity in a way, at least secular atheistic modernity. But of course, the good news in all of that is, well, without a God, there isn't a God that will muddle with us. Eric Weinstein, he was on a He had a little Discord server, and he was in a room there, and I dropped in, and almost had a little interchange with him, but my headphone went out, and he said basically to the effect of, well, the problem with God is that you don't know what's on his mind, and you'd better, paraphrasing, you'd better very well be worried about that. And part of the excitement about the death of God is that if there is no God and nor gods, then basically we can slide onto the throne and manage things for him to the degree that we have the power and the competence and the knowledge to manage the world.
Well, we've got a long way with that viewpoint. You know, that reductionist materialism has made us unbelievably powerful technologically, but the downside of that is that it's stripped the world of meaning, and that's produced a crisis of faith. And you might object, well, the world's necessarily been stripped of meaning, but it's not always that obvious just exactly what constitutes what's necessary. So, in the middle of this existential chaos, the false idol of apocalyptic ideology inevitably beckons. So what's that proposition? Well, you lose your traditional faith, your traditional religious faith. You still need an interpretive structure to guide you. And so what you might say is that, well, as the classic God of the monotheistic Western tradition collapses, then his polytheistic adversaries rise up to replace him. You are bound to act out your belief in something. And maybe it's your own hedonistic will, a fragmented, impulsive, hedonistic will. And you might think that's you, but that's just a lower, that's just a sequence of lower gods that are possessing you. So we find ourselves in consequence, inundated by a continual onslaught of ominous, demoralizing messages, most particularly in the form of environmental catastrophism. The insistence that we all confront a severe and immediately pending emergency of biological destruction, causally associated with our degenerate social structures, the patriarchy, the oppressive patriarchy, and their excess and destructive industrial production.
So of course, and then here comes the commercial. So of course, the bad guy then is, oh, this environmental catastrophism and the attempts to remediate socially. Oh, look, a free ad for ExpressVPN on the PVK's channel. Back to, where is it? Back to Brett Anderson's quote. There's a human being who has turned out badly, who does not have enough spirit to enjoy, but just enough education to realize this. He is bored, disgusted, and despises himself. Having inherited some money, he is deprived even of the last comfort, the blessings of work, self-forgetfulness in daily labor. Such a person, take that right out of the book of Ecclesiastes, such a person who is fundamentally ashamed of his existence especially ends up in a state of habitual revenge, will to revenge. What do you suppose he finds absolutely necessary to give himself in his own eyes the appearance of superiority over more spiritual people and to attain the pleasure of an accomplished revenge, at least in his own imagination? Always morality. You can bet on that. Always big moral words. Always the rub-a-dub of justice, wisdom, holiness, and virtue.
Leon talked about it with many wise people. This is a quasi-religious worldview replacement for our original traditional religious viewpoint. And it's predicated on a narrative, a story. We see the world.
Now our friend Nate, the Christian anarchist, would jump in at this point and say, but wasn't sort of the Christendom worldview, this organized structure whereby we had Earth and its comforts by the tail and had to organize that with at least a higher quotient of tyranny and order than is perhaps necessary?
World through a story, inevitably. A description of the structures through which we see the world is a story. the apocalyptic environmentalist ethos is a story, and it has characters, and here's the story. The narrative generating these messages, quasi-religious in its structure and intensity, paints a dismal existential picture. The individual is a rapacious, predatory, parasitical consumer. Too many mouths to feed. Society, even the little society of the family, is an oppressive, tyrannical despoiler. Marriage is a patriarchal institution, an exploitative patriarchal institution. All our economic interactions are nothing but the manifestation of a corrupt will to power. And that's the proper reading of history and the current moment. And nature herself is a hapless, fragile, virginal victim in need of continual sympathy and protection. For our sins, so the story goes, the horsemen of the apocalypse are to be loosed upon us, and justly so. The ultimate Malthusian nightmare is about to be realized. The planet is unsustainably and unforgivably overpopulated. There is simply too much fundamentally pathological human activity. Plague, political anarchy, and starvation await us all. Malthus. Malthus was a biologist who made the observation that under natural circumstances...
Well, we'll let that go for now. But you can, of course, the whole thing. Hundreds of thousands of people will watch that video. Maybe 2,000-3,000 people will watch this video. Maybe 4 or 5 if it's a biggie. One way to view this is, of course, the Western narrative. The good, decent, family-ordered society threatened by the rise of, in this case, not a bandit from the countryside, not an attack from a foreign nation group, but an assembled body of ideas, a spiritual body, a principality which mobilizes and takes people and robs from them the inheritance that was once acquired by others. In that sense, Peterson is in some ways this living in this Western. The quest for a spiritual home. Christian doctrine of suffering explains, I believe, a very curious fact about the world we live in. The settled happiness and security which we all desire, God withholds from us by the very nature of the world. But yet we struggle for it, we fight for it. Every one of us wants this for our children and our loved ones. At one point, we know that our children need challenge and suffering and hardship in order to mature and to grow, yet at the same time, we would wish that they not have it. We are here in that struggle. God withholds from us by the very nature of the world, but joy, pleasure, and merriment he has scattered broadcast. We are never safe, but we have plenty of fun and some ecstasy. It is not hard to see why. The security we crave would teach us to rest our hearts in this world and to oppose an obstacle to our return to God. And figuring out how to embody that, how to narratively embody that, how to preach that, how to live that. Many ways, that's exactly what our challenge is. So, yeah, as we go through the week, we shall continue to work on some of these themes and new themes that develop. Thank you for your time and attention. Leave a comment.